Chapter 10. He was numb as they went through customs, and Molly did most of the talking. Malcolm remained on board Garvey. Customs for Freeside consisted mainly of proving your credit. The first thing he saw when they gained the inner surface of the spindle was a branch of the Beautiful Girl coffee franchise. "Welcome to the Rue Jules Verne," Molly said. "If you have trouble walking, just look at your feet. The perspective's a bitch if you're not used to it." They were standing in a broad street that seemed to be the floor of a deep slot or canyon, its either end concealed by subtle angles in the shops and buildings that formed its walls. The light here was filtered through fresh green masses of vegetation tumbling from overhanging tiers and balconies that rose above them. The sun. There was a brilliant slash of white somewhere above them, too bright, and the recorded blue of a Cannes sky. He knew that sunlight was pumped in here with a Lado Aixon system, whose 2mm armature ran the length of the spindle, that they generated a rotating library of sky effects around it, that if the sky were turned off, he'd stare up past the armature of light to the curves of lakes, rooftops of casinos, other streets, but it made no sense to his body. "Jesus," he said, "I like this less than SAS. I'll get used to it. I was a gambler's bodyguard here for a month." "You want to go somewhere? Lie down." "Okay, I got our keys." She touched his shoulder. "What happened to you back there, man? You flatlined." He shook his head. "I don't know yet. Wait." "Okay, we get a cab or something." She took his hand and led him across Jules Verne, past a window displaying the season's Paris furs. "Unreal," he said, looking up again. "No," she responded, assuming he meant the furs. "Grow it on a collagen base. But it's mink DNA. What's it matter?" "It's just a big tube and they pour things through it," Molly said. "Tourists, hustlers, anything. And there's fine mesh money screens working every minute. Make sure the money stays here when the people fall back down the well." Armitage had booked them into a place called the Intercontinental, a sloping glass-fronted cliff face that slid down into cold mist and the sound of rapids. Case went out onto their balcony and watched a trio of tanned French teenagers ride simple hand gliders a few metres above the spray. Triangles of nylon in bright primary colours. One of them swung, banked, and Case caught a flash of cropped dark hair, brown breasts, white teeth in a wide smile. The air here smelled of running water and flowers. "Yeah," he said, "lot of money." She leaned beside him against the railing, her hand loose and relaxed. "Yeah, we were going to come here once, either here or someplace in Europe."
"We? Who?"
"Nobody," she said, giving her shoulders an involuntary toss. "You said you wanted to hit the bed, sleep. I could use some sleep."
"Yeah," Case said, rubbing his palms across his cheekbones. "Yeah, this is some place."
The narrow band of the Lado Aixon system smouldered in abstract imitation of some Bermudan sunset, striped by shreds of recorded cloud.
"Yeah," he said, "sleep."
Sleep wouldn't come. When it did, it brought dreams that were like neatly edited segments of memory. He woke repeatedly, Molly curled beside him, and heard the water, voices drifting in through the open glass panels of the balcony, a woman's laughter from the stepped condos on the opposite slope. Dean's death kept turning up like a bad card. No matter if he told himself that it hadn't been Dean, that it hadn't in fact happened at all. Someone had once told him that the amount of blood in the average human body was roughly equivalent to a case of beer. Each time the image of Dean's shattered head struck the rear wall in the office, Case was aware of another thought, something darker, hidden, that rolled away, diving like a fish just beyond his reach. Linda. Dean, blood on the wall of the importer's office. Linda. Smell of burnt flesh in the shadows of the Chibber Dome. Molly holding out a bag of ginger, the plastic filmed with blood. Dean had had her killed. Wintermute, he imagined, a little micro-whispering to the wreck of a man named Corto. the words flowing like a river, the flat personality substitute called Armitage accreting slowly in some darkened ward. The Dean analogue had said it worked with Givens, took advantage of existing situations. But what if Dean, the real Dean, had ordered Linda killed on Wintermute's orders? Case groped in the dark for a cigarette and Molly's lighter. There was no reason to suspect Dean, he told himself, lighting up. No reason. Wintermute could build a kind of personality into a shell. How subtle a form could manipulation take? He stubbed the yay-hay and out in a bedside ashtray after his third puff, rolled away from Molly, and tried to sleep. The dream, the memory, unreeled with the monotony of an unedited SimStim tape. He'd spent a month, his 15th summer, in a weekly rates hotel, fifth floor, with a girl called Marlene. The elevator hadn't worked in a decade. Roaches boiled across greyish porcelain in the drain-plugged kitchen when you flicked a light switch. He slept with Marlene on a striped mattress with no sheets. He'd missed the first wasp, when it built its paper-fine grey house on the blistered paint of the window frame. But soon, the nest was a fist-sized lump of fibre, insects hurtling out to hunt the alley below, like miniature copters buzzing the rotten contents of the dumpsters. They'd each had a dozen beers the afternoon a wasp stung Marlene. "Kill the fuckers," she said, her eyes dull with rage and the still heat of the room. "Burn them." Drunk, Case rummaged into the sour closet for Rolo's dragon. Rolo was Marlene's previous, and Case suspected at the time, still occasional boyfriend. An enormous Frisco biker with a blonde lightning bolt bleached into his dark crew cut. The dragon was a Frisco flamethrower, a thing like a fat angled head flashlight. Case checked the batteries, shook it to make sure he had enough fuel, and went to the open window. The hive began to buzz. The air in the sprawl was dead, immobile. A wasp shot from the nest and circled Case's head. Case pressed the ignition switch, counted three, and pulled the trigger. The fuel, pumped up to 100 psi, sprayed out past the white-hot coil. A 5-meter tongue of pale fire, the nest charring, tumbling across the alley. Someone cheered. "Shit!" Marlene behind him, swaying. "Stupid! You didn't burn them, you just knocked them off! They'll come up here and kill us!" Her voice soaring at his nerves. He imagined her engulfed in flames, her bleached hair sizzling a special green. In the alley, the dragon in his hand, he approached the blackened nest. It had broken open, singed wasps wretched and flipped on the asphalt. He saw the thing the shell of grey paper concealed. Horror. The spiral birth factory, stepped terraces of the hatching cells, blind jaws of the unborn moving ceaselessly, the staged progress from egg to larva, near wasp, wasp. In his mind's eye, a kind of time-lapse photography took place, revealing the thing as the biological equivalent of a machine gun, hideous in its perfection, alien. He pulled the trigger, forgetting to press the ignition, and fuel hissed over the bulging, writhing life at his feet. When he did hit the ignition, it exploded with a thump, taking an eyebrow with it. 5 floors above him, from the open window, he heard Marlene laughing. He woke with the impression of light fading, but the room was dark. Afterimages, retinal flares. The sky outside hinted at the start of a recorded dawn. There were no voices now, only the rush of water, far down the face of the Intercontinental. In the dream, just before he drenched the nest with fuel, he'd seen the TA logo of Tessier Ashpool neatly embossed into its side, as though the wasps themselves had worked it there. Molly insisted on coating him with bronzer, saying his sprawled pallor would attract too much attention. "Christ," he said, standing naked in front of the mirror. "You think that looks real?" She was using the last of the tube on his left ankle, kneeling beside him. "Nah, but it looks like you care enough to fake it." "There. There isn't enough to do your foot," She stood tossing the empty tube into a large wicker basket. Nothing in the room looked as though it had been machine-made or produced from synthetics. Expensive, Case knew, but it was a style that had always irritated him. The temper foam of the huge bed was tinted to resemble sand. There was a lot of pale wood and hand-woven fabric. "What about you?" he said. "You going to dye yourself brown?" "Don't exactly look like you spend all your time sunbathing." She wore loose black silks and black espadrilles. "I'm an exotic. I got a big straw hat for this too. You just want to look like a cheap-ass hood who's up for what he can get. So the instant tan's okay." Case regarded his pallid foot morosely, then looked at himself in the mirror. "Christ, you mind if I get dressed now?" He went to the bed and began to put his jeans on. "You sleep okay? You notice any lights?" "You were dreaming," she said. They had breakfast on the roof of the hotel, a kind of meadow studded with striped umbrellas and what seemed to Case an unnatural number of trees. He told her about his attempt to buzz the Burn AI. The whole question of bugging seemed to have become academic. If Armitage were tapping them, he'd be doing it through Wintermute. "And it was like real?" she asked, her mouth full of cheese croissant. "Like Simstim?" "He said it was. Real as this," he added, looking around. "Maybe more." The trees were small, gnarled, impossibly old, the result of genetic engineering and chemical manipulation. Case would have been hard-pressed to distinguish a pine from an oak, but a street boy's sense of style told him that these were too cute, too entirely and definitively tree-like. Between the trees, on gentle and too cleverly irregular slopes of sweet green grass, the bright umbrellas shaded the hotel guests from the unfaltering radiance of the Lado Atchison sun. A burst of French from a nearby table caught his attention. The golden children he'd seen gliding above river mist the evening before. Now he saw that their tans were uneven, a stencil effect produced by selective melanin boosting, multiple shades overlapping in rectilinear patterns, outlining and highlighting musculature. The girl's small hard breasts, one boy's wrist resting on the white enamel of the table. They looked a Case like machines built for racing. They deserved decals for their hairdressers, the designers of their white cotton ducks, for the artisans who'd crafted their leather sandals and simple jewellery. Beyond them, at another table, three Japanese wives in Hiroshima sackcloth awaited Sarari man husbands, their oval faces covered with artificial bruises. It was, he knew, an extremely conservative style, one he'd seldom seen in Shiba. "What's that smell?" he asked Molly, wrinkling his nose. "The grass. Smells that way after they cut it." Armitage and Riviera arrived as they were finishing their coffee. Armitage, in tailored khakis that made him look as though his regimental patches had just been stripped. Riviera, in a loose grey seersucker outfit that perversely suggested prison. "Molly, love," Riviera said, almost before he was settled on his chair, "you'll have to dole me out more of the medicine. I'm out." "Peter," she said, "and what if I won't?" She smiled without showing her teeth. "You will," Riviera said, his eyes cutting to Armitage and back. "Give it to him," Armitage said. "Pig for it, aren't you?" She took a flat, foil-wrapped packet from the inside pocket and flipped it across the table. Riviera caught it in mid-air. "He could off himself," she said to Armitage. "I have an audition this afternoon," Riviera said. "I need to be at my best." He cupped the foil packet in his upturned palm and smiled. Small, glittering insects swarmed out of it, vanished. He dropped it into the pocket of his seersucker blouse. "You've got an audition yourself, Case, this afternoon," Armitage said. "On that tug. I want you to get over to the pro shop and get yourself fitted for a vac suit. Get checked out on it and get out onto the boat. You've got about 3 hours. "How can we get shipped out in a shit can and you two hire a Jarl taxi?" Case asked, deliberately avoiding the man's eyes. "Zion suggested we use it. Good cover when we move. I do have a larger boat standing by, but the tug is a nice touch." "How about me?" Molly asked. "I got chores today. I want you to hike up to the far end of the axis. Work out in zero G. Tomorrow, maybe, you can hike in the opposite direction.
Stray-like, Case thought.
How soon? Case asked, meeting the pale stare.
Soon, Armitage said. Get going, Case.
Man, you're doing just fine,
Malcolm said, helping Case out of the red Sanyo vacuum suit.
Errol say you're doing just fine.
Errol had been waiting at one of the sporting docks at the end of the spindle, near the weightless axis. To reach it, Case had taken an elevator down to the hull and ridden a miniature induction train. As the diameter of the spindle narrowed, gravity decreased. Somewhere above him, he decided, would be the mountains Molly climbed, the bicycle loop, launching gear for the hang gliders and miniature microlights. Errol had ferried him out to the Marcus Garvey in skeletal scooter frame with a chemical engine.
2 hours ago, Malcolm said, I take delivery of Babylon goods for you. Nice Japan boy in a yacht. Most pretty yacht.
Free of the suit, Case pulled himself gingerly over the Hosaka and fumbled into the straps of the web.
Well, he said, let's see it.
Malcolm produced a white lump of foam, slightly smaller than Case's head, fished a pearl-handled switchblade on a green nylon lanyard out of his hip pocket of his tattered shorts and carefully slit the plastic. He extracted a rectangular object and passed it to Case.
That part of some gun, man?
No, Case said, turning it over. But it's a weapon. It's a virus.
Not on this boy, Tugman,
Malcolm said firmly, reaching for the steel cassette. A program, a virus program. Can't get into you, can't even get into your software. I've got to interface it through the deck before it can work on anything.
Well, Japan man, he say Hosaka here, tell you every what and wherefore you want to know.
Okay, well, you leave me to it, okay? Malcolm kicked off and drifted past the pilot console, busying himself with a cork gun. Case hastily looked away from the waving fronds of transparent cork. He wasn't sure why, but something about them brought back the nausea of SAS.
What is this thing? He asked the Hosaka. Parcel for me.
Data transfer from Bokris Systems GmbH Frankfurt advises under coded transmission that content of shipment is Guang Grade Mark 11 penetration program. Bokris further advises that interfaces with Ono Sondai Cyberspace 7 is entirely compatible and yields optimal penetration capabilities, particularly with regard to existing military systems. How about AI? Existing military systems and artificial intelligences.
Jesus Christ.
What did you call it?
Guang Grade Mark 11.
Is Chinese?
Yes.
Off. Case fastened the virus cassette to the side of the Hosaka with a length of silver tape, remembering Molly's story of her day in Macau. Armitage had crossed the border into Zhongshan.
On,
he said, changing his mind. Question.
Who owns Bokris?
The people in Frankfurt? Delay for interorbital transmission, said the Hosaka.
Code it.
Standard commercial code.
Done.
He drummed his hands on the Ono Sendai. Reinhold, Scientific, AG, Bern. Do it again. Who owns Reinhold? It took three more jumps up the ladder before he reached Tessier Ashpool.
Dixie, he said, jacking in, what do you know about Chinese virus programs? Not a whole hell of a lot.
Ever heard of a grading system like Quang Mark 11?
No.
Case sighed.
Well, I got a user-friendly Chinese icebreaker here. A one-shot cassette. Some people in Frankfurt say it'll cut an AI.
Possible. Sure, if it's military.
Looks like it. Listen, Dix, and give me the benefit of your background, okay? Armitage seems to be setting up a run on an AI that belongs to Tessier Ashpool. The mainframe's in Bern, but it's linked with another one in Rio. The one in Rio is the one that flatlined you that first time, so it looks like they link via Straylight, the TA home base, down the end of the spindle, and we're supposed to cut our way in with the Chinese icebreaker. So if Wintermute's backing the whole show, it's paying us to burn it. It's burning itself, and something that calls itself Wintermute is trying to get on my good side, get me to maybe shaft Armitage. What goes?
Motive. The construct said, real motive problem with an AI, not human, see?
Well, yeah, obviously.
No, I mean, it's not human, and you can't get a handle on it. Me, I'm not human either, but I respond like one, see?
Wait a sec, Kay said. Are you sentient or not.
Well, it feels like I am, kid, but I'm really just a bunch of Rom. It's one of them. Ah, philosophical questions, I guess.
The ugly laughter sensation rattled down Case's spine.
But I ain't likely to write you no poem, if you follow me. Your AI, it just might, but it ain't no way human.
So you figure we can't get on its motive?
It own itself?
Swiss citizen, but TA own the basic software and the mainframe.
That's a good one, the construct said.
Like, I own your brain and what you know, but your thoughts have Swiss citizenship.
Sure. Lots of luck, AI.
So it's getting ready to burn itself. Case began to punch the deck nervously at random. The matrix blurred, resolved, and he saw the complex of pink spheres representing a Sikkim steel combine.
Autonomy. That's the bugaboo where your AIs are concerned. My guess, Case, you're going to go in there to cut the hardwired shackles that keep this baby from getting any smarter. And I can't see how you'll distinguish, say, between a move the parent company makes and some move the AI makes on its own. So that's maybe where the confusion comes in.
Again, the non-laugh.
You see, those things, they can work real hard by themselves, time to write cookbooks or whatever. But the minute, I mean the nanosecond, the one starts figuring out ways to make itself smarter, Turing will wipe it out. Nobody trusts those fuckers, you know that? Every AI ever built has an electromagnetic shotgun wired to his forehead.
Case glared at the pink spheres of Sikkim.
Okay, he said finally. I'm slotting this virus. I want you to scan its instruction face and tell me what you think.
The half-sense of someone reading over his shoulder was gone for a few seconds, then returned.
Hot shit, Case. It's a slow virus. Takes 6 hours, estimated, to crack a military target.
Or an AI, he sighed. Can we run it?
Sure, the construct said, unless you got a morbid fear of dying.
Sometimes you repeat yourself, man.
It's my nature.
Molly was sleeping when he returned to the Intercontinental. He sat on the balcony and watched a microlight with rainbow polymer wings as it soared up the curve of Freeside, its triangular shadow tracking across meadows and rooftops until it vanished behind the band of the Lado-Atchison system.
I want a buzz, he said to the blue artifice of the sky. I truly do want to get high, you know. Trick pancreas, plug it in my liver, little bags of shit melting, fuck it all. I want a buzz.
He left without waking Molly, he thought. He was never sure with the glasses. He shrugged tension from his shoulders and got into the elevator. He rode up with an Italian girl in spotless whites, cheekbones and nose daubed with something black and non-reflective. Her white nylon shoes had steel cleats. The expensive-looking thing in her hand resembled a cross between a miniature oar and an orthopedic brace. She was off for a fast game of something, but Case had no idea what. On the roof meadow, he made his way through the grove of trees and umbrellas until he found a pool, naked bodies gleaming against turquoise tiles. He edged into the shadow of an awning and pressed his chip against a dark glass plate.
Sushi, he said. Whatever you got.
10 minutes later, an enthusiastic Chinese waiter arrived with his food. He munched raw tuna and rice and watched people tan.
Christ, he said to his tuna. I'd go nuts.
Don't tell me, someone said. I know it already. You're a gangster, right?
He squinted up at her. Against the band of sun.
A long, young body and a melanin-boosted tan, but not one of the Paris jobs.
She squatted beside his chair, dripping water on the tiles.
Kath, she said.
Lupus, after a pause.
What kind of name is that?
Greek, he said.
Are you really a gangster?
The melanin boost hadn't prevented the formation of freckles.
I'm a drug addict, Kath.
What kind?
Stimulants. Central nervous system stimulants. Extremely powerful central nervous system stimulants.
Well, do you have any?
She leaned closer. Drops of chlorinated water fell on the leg of his pants.
No. That's my problem, Kath. Do you know where we can get some?
Kath rocked back on her tanned heels and licked at a strand of brownish hair that had pasted itself beside her mouth.
What's your taste? No coke,
No amphetamines, but up. It's got to be up. And so much for that, he thought glumly, holding his smile for her.
Better feel a fella mean, she said. No sweat, but it's on your chip.
You're kidding, said Cass' partner and roommate when Case explained the peculiar properties of his chipper pancreas. I mean, can't you sue them or something, malpractice?
His name was Bruce. He looked like a gender-switched version of Kath, right down to the freckles.
Well, Case said, it's just one of those things, you know, like tissue matching and all that.
But Bruce's eyes had already gone numb with boredom. Got the attention span of a gnat, Case thought, watching the boy's brown eyes. Their room was smaller than the one Case shared with Molly, and on another level, closer to the surface. Five huge cyberchromes of Tali Isham were taped across the glass of the balcony, suggesting an extended residency.
They're Death Triff, huh? Kath asked, seeing him eye the transparencies. Mine! Shot him at the SN Pyramid last time we went down the well. She was that close, and she just smiled. So natural. And it was bad there, Lupus. Day after these Christ the King tears put angels in the water, you know?
Yeah, Case said, suddenly uneasy. It's a terrible thing.
Well, Bruce cut in, about this beater you want to buy?
Thing is, can I metabolize it? Case raised his eyebrows.
I tell you what, the boy said. You do a taste. If your pancreas passes on it, it's on the house. First time's free.
I heard that one before, Kay said, taking the bright blue derm that Bruce passed across the black bedspread.
Case?
Molly sat up in bed and shook the hair away from her lenses.
Who else, honey?
Who's got into you?
The mirrors followed him around the room.
I forgot how to pronounce it, he said, taking a tightly rolled strip of bubble-packed blue derms from his shirt pocket.
Christ, she said, just what we needed. Truer words were never spoken.
I let you out of my sight for 2 hours and you score.
She shook her head. I hope you're going to be ready for our big dinner date with Armitage tonight. This 20th century place, we get to watch Riviera strut his stuff too.
Yeah,
Kay said, arching his back. His smile locked into a rictus of delight.
Beautiful.
Man, she said, if whatever that is can get in past what those surgeons did to you in Chiba, you're going to be in a sad-ass shape when it wears off.
Bitch, 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 he said, unbuckling his belt. Doom, gloom, all I ever hear.
He took his pants off, his shirt, his underwear.
I think you ought to have sense enough to take advantage of my unnatural state.
He looked down.
I mean, look at this unnatural state.
She laughed.
It won't last.
But it will, he said, climbing into the sand-coloured temper foam. That's what's so unnatural about it.